Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Surgeons have been glamorized on ER. They're revered, but also regarded with no small fear and suspicion. In his new book, Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, Boston surgical resident and New Yorker magazine writer Atul Gawande pulls back the curtain and exposes the unvarnished reality, the sweaty palms and slippery fingers, the burnout and wandering attention of modern medicine. The only way that surgical residents can learn their trade is by practicing on real patients. Even the best medical veterans make mistakes. Sometimes they make life-saving diagnoses, too. And then they make miracles, all in the same day. In this hour, we're traveling into the operating room with Atul Gawande and taking a demystified look at the delicate balance of doctor-patient relations and decision-making on a scalpel's edge. What is the responsibility of doctors to their patients for full human candor? How much do you really want to know? And what image does the public have of doctors today? What happens when they make mistakes? Do we ever know? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Atul Gawande, a surgical resident in Boston and author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Good evening and welcome, Atul Gawande.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Atul Gawande, it might be great if you just start with right into your book with us a little bit here. It has so much vivid, sometimes stomach-churning description of what it's like to confront the down and dirty of a surgical operating room. Things don't always go as expected, and you're not afraid in this book to talk to us about those lapses, those moments when a doctor's best instincts turn out to be wrong. Can you give us a little sample from the top of your book?
All right. I was once on trauma duty when a young man about 20 years old was rolled in, shot in the buttock. His pulse, blood pressure, and breathing were all normal. A clinical assistant cut the clothes off him with heavy shears, and I looked him over from head to toe, trying to be systematic but quick about it. I found the entrance wound in his right buttock cheek, a neat red half-inch hole. I could find no exit wound. No other injuries were evident. He was alert and scared, more of us than of the bullet. "I'm fine," he insisted. "I'm fine." But on the rectal exam, my gloved finger came back coated with fresh blood, and when I threaded a urinary catheter into him, bright red flowed from his bladder, too. The conclusion was obvious. The blood meant that the bullet had gone inside him, through both his rectum and his bladder, I told him. Major blood vessels, his kidney, other sections of bowel may have been hit as well. He needed surgery, I said, and we had to go now. He saw the look in my eyes, the nurses already packing him up to move, and he nodded almost involuntarily, putting himself in our hands. Then the gurney wheels were whizzing, IV bags swinging, people holding doors open for us to pass through. In the operating room, the anesthesiologist put him under. We made a fast, deep slash down the middle of his abdomen, from his ribcage to his pubis. We grabbed retractors and pulled him open, and what we found inside was nothing. No blood, no hole in the bladder, no hole in the rectum, no bullet. We peeked under the drapes at the urine coming out of the catheter. It was normal now, clear yellow. It didn't have even a tinge of blood anymore. We had an X-ray machine brought into the room and got X-rays of his pelvis, his abdomen, and also his chest. They showed no bullet anywhere. All of this was odd, to say the least. After almost an hour more of fruitless searching, however, there seemed nothing to do but sew him up. A couple days later, we got yet another abdominal X-ray. This one revealed a bullet lodged inside the right upper quadrant of his abdomen. We had no explanation for any of this, how a half-inch-long lead bullet had gotten from his buttock to his upper belly without injuring anything, why it hadn't appeared on the previous x-rays, or where the blood we had seen had come from. Having already done more harm than the bullet had, however, we finally left it and the young man alone. We kept him in the hospital for a week. Except for our gash, he turned out fine.
Atul Gawande, reading from his new book, Complications, A Surgeon's Note on an Imperfect Science, they say that writers can be dangerous. a resident, a doctor in the surgery room who can write about it like that, I don't know, you may be considered dangerous by your fellow doctors. This is a view of medicine, of what goes on behind the closed doors of the operating room that we are almost never privy to, and you've delivered page after page after page of it here. Unafraid, I guess, in the way that a young doctor might be, to share the ambiguities, the uncertainties, the moments of fear, the moments of panic that doctors go through in learning their trade, and I guess later in their careers as well. How common is this kind of mistake, this kind of clutch decision that turns out wrong, and how candid are doctors in talking with patients about it?
Well, just writing about this book, I was actually not unafraid. I was a lot afraid. And yet at the same time, I think what startled me about coming into medicine, as you say, I'm a young doctor. I'm in my seventh year, nearing the end of my training as a surgeon. Mm-hmm. And what I found is how fundamentally human an endeavor it is. What we think of when we think about medicine is all the technology and all the know-how and the massive amount of knowledge that is the 21st century form of medicine. And yet when you get in closer and see what you experience, it's the messier, more fragile world of the individual doctor and the individual patient sorting through it all. And so what I describe is common in the sense that things are always unexpected. The vast majority of time, things do turn out the way you expect them to. There are always little wrinkles you can't quite explain, and yet things turn out for the best. But when you come down to it, you know, you go to the doctor, you have a terrible belly pain, and it's the medicines you want and the technology and clear answers. But what you get instead is just a doctor, someone with bad hair and a weak chin and bad jokes, mm-hmm. and some things they know and some things they don't.
You really take us behind the mask in a way we're not accustomed to, on issues of competence, on issues of confidence, on fallibility, this kind of demystifying of medicine. Doctors, I don't know if they're taught, but they certainly learn how to convey to patients an air of confidence and mastery. In your experience, how often is that genuine, and how often is that a cover, perhaps even a necessary cover, for the ambiguity that's necessarily part of coming to a diagnosis and a solution?
I don't think the confidence is a cover. It's, you know, part of what attracted me to surgery in particular. I mean, in all of medicine, this is the situation. The information that you have sitting down with a patient is imperfect. The science has holes in it. You have people's lives on the line, and yet action and decisions have to be taken. And what always struck me about surgery in particular is, well, there's a saying about surgeons, sometimes wrong, never in doubt. Mm-hmm. And that's usually taken as the criticism of surgeons. But for me, it was the attraction. It was the ability to carve through all this uncertainty and yet make a decision, understand there were the possibility of mistakes and terrible consequences, and yet the best ones could make wise decisions nonetheless.
But take us. I guess the first question has to be then: how much of the? You're very candid about the sort of sweaty palm phenom. Yeah. How much of that is just being a new, young, inexperienced doctor, and how much of that never goes away, as far as you know, at your rather young age in the practice of medicine?
Well, the sweaty palms are for sure there when you start out in training and
give us an example.
Face the prospect of doing your very first things. I tell the story of the very first patient I had, who was a young woman who came in the emergency room, who had, of all things, a 2x4 and stuck to a nail and then stuck right into her foot. And she came in. It was And what did she want? She wanted help, for God's sake. The rest of the team was stuck in a trauma. And so I had to go help this young woman out. And it seems pretty obvious. What I had to do was pull that board out of the foot.
Pull the nail out, I guess, or the screw, whatever.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was a screw, in fact, and pull that screw out. And I can tell you, sitting there with that woman shrieking on the end of this nail, I was worried, would I fracture her foot? Would I cause bleeding? Was this, in fact, the right thing to do? And that sweaty feeling is there when you start out. What shocked me, what surprised me, I sat down with my father, who's a surgeon who's been in practice for 30 years as mm-hmm. a urologist, and he said he still has that feeling whenever he takes on anything new, and it turns out that almost every year there's something new. He describes an experience of finding that 70%, 75% of what he does today is medicine that he was never taught to do when he was in training.
I guess pulling a nail out of a foot is something that awful or not, a lot of us can imagine doing in an emergency. But you're also called on as a young doctor to really intervene in the body. Give us some example of how you learned to, I don't know, do something more complex, really getting into the human body in a more invasive way.
Well, the core, of course, as a surgeon, is how do you operate on people? And it starts out with simply the incision and then expands to opening beyond the incision into someone's abdomen, finding a cancer, knowing how to locate it.
What's the first time you do that? When do you first actually put a scalpel into someone's flesh and start cutting? At what stage in your training? And who's that person? And do they know that it's the first time you've done it?
Right. So the first time for me was, of all things, as a medical student. I was standing across from a surgeon as we were doing an abdominal case. I'd been standing watching him helping hold instruments now and again for a few weeks on end. And then suddenly one day he had the nurse hand me the knife. And the patient was asleep under the drapes, and I swept my hand along with the knife in hand along the line that he had dotted for me, and found it was much harder to cut through skin than I expected.
This is the abdomen again?
This is the abdomen. Mm-hmm. Much harder, springier, tougher tissue. I had to cut twice to get through. I desperately wanted to make sure that line was straight because, of course, this would be the scar this patient would wake up with. Mm-hmm. The real dilemma is that what we all want is perfection without practice, which is impossible. And so the learning goes on in some way, and it has to be hidden. I give the example of my own child who had to have cardiac surgery, and a junior fellow wanted to be the one to take care of my son after mm-hmm. discharge. And I told him I wanted the associate chief of cardiology, of course, to be the one taking care.
So
I wanted
you
the most
you were not playing along with the
I
training
I didn't
game.
Want to play with the game. And when I sat down and thought about it afterwards, I realized, looking back, that there were moments that people learned on him. Why the surgeon who put the stitches in his own heart was a resident, the person who put the central line into his chest, a intern. And it was that learning that had to happen.
Jack Beatty, we don't go in thinking that we're going to be guinea pigs, but I guess we know somewhere in the back of our minds that sometimes we have to be.
We have to be. I had an experience like that recently. I have a son who's a college baseball player. He came home and he threw something to me, and naturally his arm overwhelmed me, and it broke through the glove, and ball broke through the glove and split my lip. So I had to go to the hospital, the emergency room. And the young doctor there, that's a new sensation, too. We all have it. The doctors get younger and younger. The young doctor there said she hadn't done this sort of sewing before, but she'd give it a try if I were willing. I said, sure. Her hand shook as she approached it. And you know what? I was moved by that. And somehow, in a weird way, that gave me confidence. And you use the word in here, doctor, of tenacity. And what I was struck with was this woman's moral qualities. By God, she thought she could do it. Her hand was shaking a little bit, but by that, you couldn't tell I had a scar there for anything. She did a great job. I was just struck. You say, skill can be taught, doctor, but tenacity, That's something a doctor has to have.
Jack Beatty, you are a great soul, being moved so by the shaking hand coming toward your lip with the needle. Wow. We're talking with Atul Gawande tonight, Dr. Atul Gawande. We're demystifying medicine. He's written a new book called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, and he's giving us the lowdown and dirty behind the mask of medicine on issues of competence, of confidence, of fallibility. What do you think? Do you see the human fallibility in your own doctor or doctors? Do we want our doctors to admit their fears and failures or to maintain the comforting mystique? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Atul Gawande. He's author of Complications, A Surgeon's Note on an Imperfect Science, where he takes us on a very candid tour of the clammy, sweaty-palmed moments of doctoring for young doctors, older doctors, doctors all the way along the line. It's not always that that mastery that's felt by the professional who steps up to do what requires doing. Do you see human fallibility in your own doctor, and do we want our doctors to admit their fears and failures or to maintain the comforting mystique of infallibility? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Atul Gawande, talk to us about uncertainty. You know, patients always have the feeling that there are conversations going on that they're not privy to. You'd like to think that those were, you know, calm, cool, and collected, and that always came to a judicious decision about the best way to go forward. What's been your experience? What have you seen about the doctor's conversation out of earshot of the patient about what to do next?
Well, what this comes around to is, why is it that things don't always turn out the way you expected? And why is there, what are these gray areas that lead to unexpected results? Well, one of them is fallibility. Another is that there are still mysteries in medicine, places where that are still terra incognita, things we don't understand.
Are these very exotic things or everyday things?
These are sometimes very everyday things. Pain, for example, is still a mechanism that we don't completely understand. So people come to us with a terrible back pain, and you have the puzzle of, well, this back pain that's been around for 3 months, it's completely incapacitated. And you take x-rays up and down, you don't find the spot where exactly things might be wrong. And understanding why that is, why some people are subjected to operations in the back that may not have great consequences. Nausea is another example. It's a mechanism of it's the second most common misery that people come to doctors with and complain to doctors about, and yet our medicines are poor for it, and we don't even understand in really good ways why nausea occurs. The third way in which things may not turn out the way you expect them is simple uncertainty. That is, the sheer variety and complexity of individuals, even when you've gotten rid of all the mistakes and have a science that has fewer holes in it, there's still the hard question of, when someone comes to you and they have a pain in a certain place, is that pain really what the textbooks tell you it's going to be, or something else? Mm-hmm. And so you have debates. You have people, yes, sometimes out of earshot, discussing, should you be even operating on this patient? Should this patient be on the medicine that they're on? And it's an experience I think a lot of people have had of going to more than one doctor and feeling like they've heard more than one story. And trying to sort through these things, trying to explain these things we don't necessarily talk about. Why do mistakes occur? Why is there uncertainty? Where are the holes in our knowledge is exactly why I've turned to writing.
How do you go ahead when you don't know which way to go ahead? And yet you must, because the patient has a problem.
That's right. Now, on some basic level, you don't always have to go ahead. You can discuss with the patient the fact that there are deep uncertainties here. And in fact, I think that's very important to spell out for people what your probabilities are that you're working with. And I think we're slowly getting better at it, but still have a ways to go. But then there comes the core moment when, because you have high stakes, someone is sick, they have fever, they're in deep pain, you do have to take action. And there are terrible dangers that you don't want to miss. And so sometimes you decide because someone has a pain in the right place and they're looking just sick enough, even though you take this patient I spoke about who has the bullet in the abdomen, why the odds were just so great that something terrible is going on, you have to take them and look, and yet you can be wrong. And that's the hard choice, is to live with the fact that sometimes you can be wrong and that sometimes by being wrong, there are high consequences.
We're talking with Atul Gawande. He's author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Can we accept the reality of imperfection, of human failings in medicine? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sean is on the line. Welcome, Sean. You're on the air.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a great topic. And, Doctor, I think it's a great book. I'm certainly looking forward to taking a look at it. My comment really has to do with the fact that I'm definitely in favor of a system that requires young surgeons to actually train on individuals. My personal feeling there is that feeling or sense of infallibility that sometimes does develop in all of us as professionals doesn't have the chance to be instilled in a young surgeon. And so in my own case, for example, some recent surgery I had, I was conscious and was able to observe the actual relationship between a resident and the experienced physician.
And was it confidence building, Sean?
Oh, absolutely. No question.
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely got the sense that the resident was good but wasn't positive of everything and was constantly checking with the surgeon about various things that was going on.
You were glad to have the more experienced guy there. Sean, thanks for your call. Atul Gawande, what about this issue of young doctors being open to learning, open to fear as well, open to fear of failure, obviously? Older doctors, of course, the cliche is that they develop a sense of being all-knowing, they don't want to be questioned, et cetera. Have you found that to be the case in working with older doctors? Is that a necessary part of going through an entire career in medicine? To develop that hard shell?
Confidence grows with time. And so older doctors do tend to be more confident. And it also, though, the best doctors I know who are the older doctors are the ones who are confident enough to know that they don't always know, that they can express the notion that that there are arenas in which they're not the masters of the domain. And that's what you begin to learn as a young surgeon, is understanding the arenas in which you just have to plow ahead, but also those places where you have to accept that there are some things you just don't know and that you can tell people about this.
You've written about when doctors go bad, and I guess that could happen at any time of life. But in your case, you wrote about an older doctor who just starts to lose it. What were the dynamics of that? How were they recognized? And is the medical community any more open than others in sharing with the world when one of their own is not quite up to snuff anymore?
This was an extraordinary opportunity and occasion for me, which was that a surgeon, an orthopedist who'd been a fantastic orthopedist for 15 years, but then became someone who simply burned out and started harming people. To the point that a few years later, he finally had his license taken away. He was willing to talk to me about what had happened and why. I think because he wanted to understand it himself.
What was it?
And what it was, from his perspective, simply the process of, in a 40-year career, almost all of us hit a wall at times when things don't go well. And for him, this moment happened about 10, 15 years into his career, and he was 100-hour weeks for that entire time, and he just simply burned out. And he didn't pull back. Instead, he just kept plowing ahead. And when he did, and he stopped caring about people, he really hurt them. A woman called on the phone saying, I have pus coming out of my knee. And he said, oh, just take an antibiotic. When what really was happening was a deep infection he should have known about, and she'd lost her entire knee. The flip side of it is, why is it that he continued to practice with complication after complication after complication for 4 or 5 years? And what you saw is a pattern that we've seen recently with the Boston pre-scandal. It is the difficulty of professions policing themselves. Colleagues often know something's going on but feel unable to take decisive action. They dither. Mm-hmm. And in his case, they did dither. They gave him speeches for a year. People would take him aside at a cocktail party and tell him, you've got to stop doing this. And he'd promise. He'd say, okay, I will.
But not really intervening to do the right thing.
No. And then the junior colleagues who were too powerless to take action were often the ones who would step in and tell patients, mm-hmm. maybe you want to see somebody else. Mm-hmm. Or why don't you go get a second opinion on this one?
Jack Beatty, Americans' relationships with their medical professionals, with their doctors, have clearly changed over the last several decades. People are much more forthcoming with questions and I suppose even second-guessing their doctors now. But do you think it's come to the right kind of balance, Jack, between faith and skepticism?
Well, I don't know. I think there's something else involved, too. I mean, efficiency and money. One of the things that worries me about medicine today, not just me, and I hope a subject on which we can get some candor from our candid doctor, is the way the incentives in medicine seem to have changed with the dawn of managed care. You know, with third-party payers, the incentives favored the patient. That is to say, the extra test, the extra lab work, the extra day in the hospital. That was all sort of favoring the patient. Now, with managed care, the incentives, which are to save money, favor the company. Now, I'm wondering, doctor, how is this? Are you aware of this hurting care of people saying, damn, in the past I used to be able to get six tests and that sixth one would have got this disease. This company, some bureaucrat someplace, won't let me do the second test, much less the sixth.
How about it? What are doctors really saying about that pressure?
You see it, and you see doctors complaining a lot about the pressures coming from insurers to move people through, from hospital administrators to see ever more people. And yet it is not the dominant thing that makes medicine so hard and makes this experience between doctors and patients so fraught. I think the thing is that medicine has now become so incredibly complex and also powerful. It can certainly extend people's lives and improve their lives, whether they have heart attacks or cancer or anything else. On the other hand, the notion that doctors are gods is long gone. And so you have pressures from all sides, certainly from insurers, certainly from patients, certainly from colleagues, questioning what it is you're doing and pushing on your judgment. But we've reached the point, I think, in an appropriate way, that people are expected to take a deeper role in their own decisions, to not simply do what doctors tell you, and on tight budgets with healthcare costs for every pill skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. It's not surprising there's pressure coming from all angles. I think that is, at some level, always going to be part of the reality of the job.
But are we getting a degraded medicine as a result of that pressure overall, ultimately?
I don't think so. I think what you have is doctors fighting back, and it makes the job harder on our end. And at the same time, though, this is not the dominant or even a hugely important part of the reason why mistakes occur or complications happen.
Mm-hmm. Rajiv is on the line. Welcome, Rajiv. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Atul, hi. I'm an engineer, and my wife is a doctor, and I have this argument with her all the time. And my argument is, when any other professional treats or deals with their customers, the professional gives them a choice. Like I, as an engineer, would provide a solution A and solution B to a customer, and then the customer would choose finally what solution to pick. Or an analyst would say, okay, this stock is good for this reason and this stock is good for so-and-so reason.
So do you want a menu, a punch list, Rajiv, from your doctor when
exactly.
when your health is on the line?
Yeah, my doctor would should basically give me, okay, penicillin does this for you and amoxicillin does that for you, and the final choice should be mine. Why doesn't it happen?
Well, okay. Atul Gawande?
I think it is actually happening more and more. The choices now are being switched to the patient in the sense that before, doctors did simply tell people what to do. Now we have to ask patients permission to do an operation. We have to say if it's done properly, you have to say what the risks are and what the benefits are and what the alternatives are. And good medicine has to involve giving people key choices.
Rajiv, are you getting that kind of list of options from your doctor?
Absolutely not. I mean, all I get is a prescription and many times basically a bad attitude saying, okay, I know better.
Rajiv, thanks for your call. Atul Gawande, where do attitudes get formed in doctors? Does it just boil down to personality, or are there different schools or sort of continents of medicine that produce more or less imperious or communicative doctors?
All of the above. I think it's cultural. It's generational. It's also how many people you have sitting out in the waiting room. It's your mood that day. It's an amazing number of things that come down to what happens when somebody sits down and you talk to them. And I think it's not good that the experience of Rajiv is that he goes to a doctor and has a problem and is given a prescription without a good explanation for what the risks and benefits are, why, what the choices are. There's a lot, nonetheless. I know this from the other side as well. I'm sure that at times I've sat with patients and not given them the full range of options, not answered all their questions.
Deliberately because of pressures of time or something else?
Both deliberately at times because of the pressures of time, having to triage all the things you have to do in a given hour. Also sometimes not necessarily deliberately because you may simply have a chemistry with some patient that goes in the wrong direction. And it can be that kind of a strange level of things that are almost hard to put your finger on.
Mm-hmm. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Great. Good evening, gentlemen. It's a wonderful program. Dr. Gawande, I'd just like to say that I've appreciated your pieces over the months, actually, in The New Yorker.
And thank you.
Just this evening, I have to say I'm actually surprised, and I must even encourage to hear so many folks embrace, essentially, the uncertainties and risks of subjecting themselves, really, to medical apprenticeship. Jack Beatty, for instance, reports that he's not just accepting, but he's actually moved that a young resident filled with tenacity can approach him with tremors. But I think it's important that we recognize that the costs can, in many cases, be much more than a sort of misstitched superficial wound. I'm not sure. I wonder if Jack would feel the same way if, in fact, he had occasion to watch maybe a son or daughter undergo a much more difficult and dangerous procedure.
I would have fainted.
Yeah, exactly. And, in fact, I'd like to pick up, maybe give Dr. Gawande a chance to pick up on something he's written fairly recently. He made the case in reference to some evidence from, I believe, England, but do correct me if I'm wrong, that there's some hard data to show that even current physicians who are not in training, but to the extent that any physician is never not in training, but practicing physicians who are learning new procedures can be shown to have much greater death rates in the early stages of learning that procedure.
Yes, he does write about that, Mike. Thanks for your call, Mike. And Atul Gawande, how about it? Mike says, you know, if it's your own kid and it's an open heart, then that apprenticeship may not be something you want practiced here. You've written about the difficulty and costs of introducing anything new into a physician's practice.
This study he talked to brings home the dilemma in a very tragic way. The Great Ormond Street Hospital is the great hospital in England for children, and the cardiac surgeons there had been doing a procedure for a heart defect. The heart defect is a transposition of your aorta, where the child's aorta would be put in the wrong place in the heart, and those children would die within days to weeks. Mm-hmm. The fix was a fix that only partly worked. It kept them alive into their 20s, maybe their 30s. And then a new procedure came along. It was very hard to learn. It at other hospitals had been a procedure that could let them live into the 60s. So these doctors started to learn it, and their death rate went up. It went up threefold, fourfold. But then within a few months after that, within a year or two, they had it so that every child who came through their hospital with this procedure who would live into their 60s.
But people paid to be in the early part of that learning curve.
That's right. So the core dilemma is that if we want progress, why that learning curve had to happen.
We're backstage tonight with an honest doctor, Atul Gawande. Can we accept the reality of imperfection, of human failings in medicine? Do we have the right balance of faith and skepticism in our doctors? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by Atul Gawande. He's demystifying medicine for us. He's got a new book out called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. He's finishing up his own residency as a surgeon in Boston, and he's telling it like it is, taking us backstage with a great candor, a kind of candor we don't ordinarily see. Do we want our doctors to admit their fears and failures or to maintain the comforting mystique? Can you imagine the responsibility of cutting open another human being's chest cavity? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Atul Gawande, we've had several people tonight calling for this candor and openness, and obviously we have an impulse to know exactly what's going on with us. But I wonder also, in reading your book, if there's not some level at which there are necessary illusions between patient and doctor. The doctor who's aware of how uncertain all this treatment must be because physics are uncertain, because physiognomy is uncertain. On the other hand, the patient who wants a sense of confidence when they're going under the knife or whatever they're going under.
I do wonder whether at some level we need to believe our doctor is infallible in order to be able to trust in them, to put ourselves in our own in their hands. There was a patient I talk about in this who is a woman who had terrible nausea and vomiting to the point of eventually having bleeding from her own stomach. Mm. No one understood where that was coming from. And the doctor who told her first that she didn't know why this was happening was dismissed by her out of hand. It took another month of pain and terror before she figured out that this was actually the doctor she loved the most, the one who was willing to admit that she didn't know what was going on, mm-hmm. but would be with her through the whole thing.
To go on a journey together.
Exactly.
Bring their expertise, but be honest about where they were and weren't.
Exactly. I think that, you know, I think the core element, we're used to thinking that if a complication occurs or a mistake occurs, mm-hmm. for sure, that this must be because of bad doctors. And that's often the way it's written on the media, why somebody's wrong leg gets cut off or the wrong drug gets given to them.
It sounds like a mistake, I must say.
It is a mistake. And yet a core thing that's hard to understand is that it's good doctors, not bad doctors, who are the ones who make most mistakes. And thinking through what that means.
What do you mean? Why? If the doctor cuts off the wrong leg, that's a good doctor?
Well, because it is a – mistakes are part of what – of all of our experiences, and mistakes are common enough because the risks are high enough, and also because some of our systems don't work well enough that – let me give you an example. Every time I pick up a prescription pad, I'm a mistake waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. I write 1,000 prescriptions. I know I'm going to get the decimal point wrong in one place on a couple of
someday, others. Somewhere, sometime.
Exactly. I know that my handwriting will be misread by a pharmacist at some point along the way. Well, when that happens, what do? We want that doctor's license if somebody has really been harmed because they made a terrible mistake. Mm-hmm. And yet it happens again and again and again, almost like a Greek tragedy. And for a decade or more, we've had a solution that would eliminate 80% of these problems, which is writing prescriptions on a computer. Mm-hmm. Now, why haven't we adopted it? It's because we're so used to seeing it in this other way, that the problem is the person rather than the whole context of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beattie, are you willing to open yourself with full humanity to the doctor's fellow human fallibility, or do you want a doctor who strides forth, you know, with purposeful, deliberate perfection?
Well, I sure as heck want a surgeon that way.
That's right.
I can take my internist as an on-the-one-hand, on-the-other-hand guy, but my surgeon, boy, I want steel. But, you know, the other side of these mistakes, you cite the data in the book, Doctor, there's an estimate of 40,000 people a year die from these mistakes. That's a lot.
Yes. Well, let me put the numbers in context. On the one hand, you have 97% of people who go through hospitals and get very risky things done to them who come through with no complications whatsoever. Mm-hmm. 3% have a serious complication. Half of those are avoidable ones. And if those avoidable ones can be called errors, that still means, even though it's around 1%, that still means tens of thousands of people mm-hmm. at risk. Mm-hmm. Now, 1 in 100 error rate is still not acceptable when you have that kind of number of people on the line. Mm-hmm. And the ways that we deal with it, though, is not going to come from throwing out every one of those doctors, because we're going to throw out all of us, but from understanding, you know, why does that prescription pad end up being so lethal in the first place?
Or changing the systems, you mean?
That's right.
Yeah.
Figuring out the 100 steps that that it takes to get somebody well from a pneumonia, and then figuring out why it is that each one of those steps might go wrong.
But to take it down to an individual patient's experience, how do you know? Is there any way of knowing when the doctor is stepping off the right path?
Well, it you can imagine it's like being on an airplane and asking, how do you know if the landing gear are going to come out? You can't know, and that's part of the frightening thing of being in the medical experience. There is so much going on that it's hard to encapsulate for the patient. It's hard to control, and there are patients who will come in and want to control every one of those steps to make them go perfectly, and it can't be done. Whereas we do have a responsibility as a profession to figure out how to make all of those steps go better. Some of these mistakes can't be helped, but there is a lot more that can be when we begin to tackle these problems in a forthcoming way.
So are we more likely to cut down the number of mistakes when doctors can be more forthright with the patients about the margin of error, or do we want to put more pressure on them to be right and have the appearance of being right all the time?
Well, I agree with Jack Beatty that you want that surgeon with steel who can look at the odds and simply stride ahead and make a firm recommendation and proceed. On the other hand, it does likely lead to improved care and to fewer mistakes when we can be open about the ways in which things go wrong, when patients can talk to us about the ways in which things go wrong without being afraid that they will be chastised for it.
Atul Gawande, thanks so much for coming on with that candor tonight. Atul Gawande is author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. You can read an excerpt from the book. It's on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us with your busted lip and all tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, two Americans share their experience freeing slaves in Sudan. This is On Point. One of the world's most brutal civil wars is taking place in the East African nation of Sudan. Since 1983, nearly 2 million lives have been taken in fighting between southern Christian and animist rebels and the Arab government in Khartoum. Still more Sudanese have been abducted into slavery by marauders on both sides. Earlier this month, two Boston residents, Tommy Calvert Jr. and Dr. Gloria White Hammond, went to Sudan to buy back freedom for 6,000 slaves. Their group was sponsored by the American Anti-Slavery Group and Christian Solidarity International. Tonight, they share what it was like to encounter slavery head-on in Sudan.
I knew that I wouldn't be able to prepare myself for what I was going to see. One of the young men who went before me, he told me that when he went prepared to die. And I wasn't prepared to die. In many respects, I was. Don't get me wrong, but I didn't necessarily have such a, I guess, a negative aspect of it. I knew that I could die. I knew that it was very dangerous. And so I was thinking a lot about my life. But I thought even more about the lives of the people there. And if I were a slave, I would want somebody to come and free me too.
My name is Gloria White Hammond. I am a minister, and I'm also a pediatrician. This is actually my second trip to Sudan. The first one was in July, actually on Independence Day. We were involved in the redemption, the buying of freedom for over 6,700 slaves. What was interesting to me is that that was the first time that I actually realized that the overwhelming majority of the slaves were women and children.
The first day of actually going out and seeing the slaves was extremely, extremely challenging. I had a video camera that I took to document it, and I happened to be pulling it out because as I walked up the hill, I saw the slaves sitting under a tree, and I wanted to get that shot. And I fell behind the group. And when I got back to the group, one of the folks with us from Los Angeles, he said, "Don't ever fall behind the group again because we've been bombed and shot at before." It was kind of surreal, really. I remember the first moment when I looked into the eyes of the slaves. You could see the suffering and the history almost in their eyes and the way they looked.
I remember one woman who told of what was happening when she was in her village. It was early in the morning, and the raiders came, and she had two children. One was two, and the other was around three. And after they captured her, they wanted her to carry some items as they began their march to the north. And she refused because she said she had to take care of her children. And so they shot the children. There was one boy whose face was so deformed that I thought it must have been a congenital deformity. And so I approached him, and his mother was with him, and asked him, his mother, if he was born like that. And she said, no, he was 11 years old, and 4 years earlier he had been charged with the responsibility to tend to the cattle, and he lost a cow. And when his master heard that, he was so angry that he took an axe and chopped the little boy's nose off.
And there were 740 slaves, which means that's 37 million Sudanese pounds that they will receive.
What is it like when they are freed? There's almost a ceremony that we have where we bring the Arab retrievers, who are really the good guys. They're slave traders who, in many cases for free, bring back these slaves. In other cases, we do pay. You can buy a slave, sadly, for $33. So there is a mat laid out, and we take out the money in front of them, about 600 or 700 at a time, so they can see that they're being paid for and that they'll never have to serve again. At that moment, they know that they're free. And then they go, and often there'll be family members waiting by in trees close by, and they'll run, and they'll jump, and they'll scream. And one of the last trips, there were two women who got up, older women, and they got up and sang a song. They led the whole 700 people in a song of joy and exuberance over their freedom, and I was holding back some tears. There is a debate out there between those who believe that these redemption processes exacerbate the problem and those of us who are on the ground. But this is not economically driven. This is a terror weapon used by the government in northern Sudan against the people in the south.
You know, for the people who have said this whole process of slave redemption is flawed, and I hear what they say, and then I look out at these people and I hear their stories and I say, well, what should I say to this boy who had his nose chopped off? That, no, you need to go back there and you need to just stay where you are and just be a man because somebody else may be benefiting monetarily here. What do I say to them? And what do I say to the people in the villages, the ones who weren't enslaved, who say, thank you for bringing our sisters home again? How can I say to them, just stay where you are and just endure it? Because some people have said that this process is flawed. I also feel an incredible sense of responsibility to see that nobody else should have to experience what my ancestors experienced.
All I can do is come back with that experience and work every day to try to encourage other people, implore other people. I have no problem even begging people to do something. There's a quote that says, vision without action is merely a dream. Action without vision just passes the time. But vision with action can change the world.
There's an old Negro spiritual that says, I ain't no ways tired. And despite 20 years of war, they ain't no ways tired.
Tommy Calvert Jr. is a senior at Tufts University. Dr. Gloria White Hammond lives in Roxbury, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.